as I indicated to you, I think it was last week when we spoke about Rav Shitz, he would not call him my teacher, but he would call him the Holy Rebbe of Rav Shitz. And the, with the explanation that there was no way that he could even approach the depth of what the Rebbe represented and what the Rebbe taught, such that he really did not feel that he had the right to call upon him or to call him his Rebbe. Tuf Kuf Pei Zayin, which is 1827, the Rebbe died. So he had roughly 11 or 12 years with the Rebbe. And after the Rebbe died, it was as though his world became desolate. He did continue to frequent the Rebbe's descendants, son-in-law, Boshevel, his son, the Jikvilov. He went to other tzaddikim of the time, the first Belzerov, Reb Sholem, Reb Herschel Zedecheva. He was someone who continued to follow the great and distinguished Hasidic leaders of the time. Nonetheless, the fervor, the fullness of his relationship with the Rav Shitz was never again really recaptured. Subsequent to that, the sons of Rav became a rabbi in a number of other communities, all of which were very short-lived. I should note, by the way, just as a kind of an interesting story, that during his early years in Rav Shitz, that amongst the things that ignited his soul was the service of tefillah. And it was during this period of time that he began to immerse himself in the study of the Kabbalah. So this was a very Hasidic experience. I mean, he was. We have to realize that, despite the fact that the Divrei Chaim at this point was already one of the recognized halachic authorities of his time, that he saw in the Rav Shitz Rav someone whose learning transcended his own. Now, this is not something for which necessarily the Rav Shitz Rav is widely known, but the Divrei Chaim's deference was not only to the Rebbe's service, but to the Rebbe's knowledge of both Nigla and Nistar. The story goes that as his passion in prayer grew, that he would lose himself in prayer with no less force of focus and concentration and intensity that he used to have in learning, except that in prayer there was a far greater outpouring of emotion. The sons of Rav was a veritable volcano of emotion. His prayer was an explosion of thunder and lightning. No one who heard his tefillahs could fail to be moved. During his years in Rav Shitz, the Rav Shitz Rav was visited by one of his peers, Rav Meir Lapta, the Hillel Shemayim. And when the Meir Lapta commiserated with the Rav Shitz Rav that as they were growing older, they became somewhat pessimistic about who was going to lead the next generation, The Rav Shitz Rav pointed to this young man and said, "You leave the world in good hands." And at the next occasion, the Rav Shitz Rav asked the his disciple Reb Chaim to daven for the Amid, and of course the moment he approached the Amid, he exploded, and it was a when he finished the davening, the Meir Lato walked over to the Rav Shetzalov and said to him, there wasn't a word or a letter that this young man failed to invest with all of the kavanas, with all of the requisite thoughts of the Ari HaKadosh. So he said, I see what you mean, he said, and I feel comforted in the knowledge that this young man will be responsible for the next generation. Parenthetically, a not dissimilar conversation took place many years earlier when the Nesivos, the famous Chavos Das, the Yankiv of Lisa, visited the Leipnik Rov in the year in which this new son-in-law was in Leipnik learning with his father-in-law, that famous year that we referred to. And the Chavos Das, who was then himself an older man, lamented the fact that he was looking about and saw no one to whom to be able to give over the next generation of halachic authority to. At which point the Baruch Tam pointed to the young man and said, this young man will do just fine. And the Chavos Das approached the Reb Chaim and spoke at length to him in learning, and he returned to the Reb Chaim and he said, I am much comforted that there is someone to succeed us. So this was someone whose resources, whose talents, whose gifts, whose genius, whose passion, whose emotion, whose devotion, whose piety, whose saintliness was such that it was immediately transmitted to whoever was a maven, and this was it was clear that this was someone who was marked to be a leader of his time. When the Divrei Chaim would daven, whenever he was davening, and he would begin to lose himself, his davening was such that in the course of his davening he would stomp his foot. And he would stomp his lame leg. Now his lame leg was full of ulcers and was bandaged. And from his constant stomping it would bleed, such that by the end of prayer there would be a little pool of blood underneath his foot. The Rebbe Shlitzer Rebbetzin, who witnessed this day in and day out, finally was so exasperated that she pushed up and she said to him, what kind of a Rebbe are you? Why don't you go up to the young man? I mean, you see what he's doing to himself, the injury that he's causing himself. Tell him that he should stomp on his healthy foot. So he turned to her and said to her, if he would know what he was doing when he was davening, I could tell him. He said, when he's davening, he doesn't know which foot he's using. And there's no way in which I can tell him, use your left foot, not your right foot. He's not conscious. So there was no way in which he could be protected against himself. After a series of short rabbinic positions, then short-lived rabbinic positions in other communities, he was invited to become the rabbi of Sanz. The Sanz Rav was, as I've indicated, was a very powerful personality. And in some of these other instances in which he served in communities after Rybnik, His strength of character, his forcefulness of conviction, earned him some spirited opposition, which eventually made things so uncomfortable that he had to leave. And the situation in Sanz promised to be more amenable to his style. Nonetheless, shortly after he was hired, there was one of the most influential members of the community who was a Talmid Chacham and a man of note in the community. His name was Rav Orland. Called in one of his employees and said to him, I want you to follow these instructions very carefully. Go to the rabbi that we just hired a week or so ago. Tell him that you have a complaint against me, that I have somehow failed to honor my contract with you, my agreement with you, that I was supposed to do such and that I'm not doing such, and that you have a complaint against me. You have to realize, not only was this Rav Orland one of the most powerful figures in the community, but it was well known to their new rabbi that he was personally responsible for the majority of his salary. So in comes this employee, lodges this complaint, and the rabbi assures him that he will summon his employer to a din Torah. So after he leaves, he calls in his shamus. He says to him, I want you to go to the Baal Nando, and I want you to, to tell him that I am summoning him to a din Torah with so-and-so, who is one of his employees. The shamus goes, and he knows that Rav Orlander is not the kind of a person anybody messes with, so he is already in a state of some trembling, and he announces his visit, and Rav Orlander says to him, what do you want? He says to him, the rabbi has ordered me to tell you that you must appear before him tomorrow for a din Torah. So he says to him, in response, he says to him, tell your rabbi that I'm too busy to fool around with his summons to din Torah, and he should forget it. This poor shamus comes back, and his teeth are chattering. He doesn't know what to say, and he tells this, and he's a young man, this, but nonetheless, clearly a man of conviction. He says to the rabbi, I came there, and he told you to take a hike. So he says to him, go back and tell him that that I find this response impertinent, intolerable, and that he must appear before me tomorrow. Goes back, once again announces himself. At this point he's really shaking, and Zalalander screams at him and says to him, go back and tell the rabbi that I will not put up with this nonsense, and that if he knows what's good for me, he should stop this summoning business forthwith. Goes back again, and he delivers the message, at which point the Sanz Rav says to him, go back and tell your employer. Now he knows he's talking to the guy who's responsible for his salary, right? And who can easily make life as miserable for him as all of his other rabbinic experiences have been. Tell him that if he doesn't appear here tomorrow at the appointed time, that I will put him into nidui. Nidui is a form of excommunication. The fella pleaded with the rabbi that he should send somebody else to deliver the message. He just didn't want to go with the message. So the rabbi insisted, and he went. He appeared before this Panas Varanda, and he stammered out his message, at which point the Varanda immediately left his home, went to the Rebbe, and he said to him, the whole thing, he says, is I just put on this whole thing is a test. I wanted to know if you really had the character to stand up to the trials of a a rabbi in this community, he said, and if you could stand up to my abuse in this short period of time, he says, then you're worthy of being the rabbi in the city. So the Divrei Chaim had his first test in Sanz, and from that point forward, he remained the rabbi of Sanz for the next 46 years. And he is known by that name as the Sanz Rov. So when the world speaks of the Sanz Rov, there's absolutely no question, no mistake about who they're referring to. This Divrei Chaim was the this individual who during that 46 years became a veritable legend. There are few people in the last two centuries who have had the impact, who have earned the universal reverence that the Divrei Chaim had. He was revered as a pillar of Aveda. His divine service, his prayer was the kind of thing which etched itself into the marrow of every single person who ever saw or heard him during the course of his davening. His Torah genius was he was an incredibly gifted Torah scholar. His halachic opinion was sought by all of the greats of his time. That's a veritable list of, if you open up the Divrei Chaim, the Shailos and Tshuvos Divrei Chaim, the response of the Divrei Chaim, almost all of the greats of his time consulted the Divrei Chaim for his word, for his opinion. Amongst whom was the Chiddush Yerim, the first Rebbe of Ger, who was himself an outstanding Torah. In fact, there is a tshuva which the Chiddush Yerim wrote to the Divrei Chaim. It's the first Ger Rebbe wrote to the Divrei Chaim, that revolved around the question of a couple who had not had children for 10 years. And the halachic implications of whether or not that warranted that they should divorce in order so that the mitzvah of the pru revu could be fulfilled in the event that it was not the husband's fault. So he concludes his. Now, by the way, this is not a chassid coming to Rebbe for his bracha. It's a halachic, complex halachic question. Nonetheless, at the conclusion, so he says to the Divrei Chaim, he says to him, he said, "I trust that you will address this issue and resolve it to everybody's satisfaction." He says, "But you really could resolve it much more quickly if you would use your considerable influence in heaven to see to it that they would be blessed with children." So there were some times when there would be some infiltration here. There'd be some contamination between the worlds of his great Talmudic genius and his Hasidus. It's also related that in one instance that he was found in writing a tshuva to be particularly engrossed in a tshuva with an uncommon intensity. Not only that, but every so often he would run and immerse himself in the mikveh again, and an abnormal number of times during the course of writing this tshuva. And when he was finally, when somebody had enough courage to present the question why he was writing this response in such an unusual way for him, he said, "The question was addressed to me by the Tzemach Tzedek, who was the third Rebbe of Lubavitch, who was himself a brilliant Talmudic scholar. He said, and when I respond to a man who is as lettered as he is, not only in Nigla, but in Ister, in other words, the Tzemach Tzedek was a genius both in the open wisdom of Torah, but also in the secrets of Torah, in the Kabbalah of Torah. He said, I need to be absolutely certain that my response will be consistent al pi Kabbalah as it is al pi Nigla. So he said, when I have to move between these two worlds, he said, each time I venture into the world of Kabbalah, he said, I have to immerse myself in the mikvah all over again. There were people, by the way, who would hide in the mikveh to be present. Now, you're not supposed to be with your Rebbe in the mikveh, so when people did this, they took their lives into their hands, but it was there is a written account from someone who was there, and when he describes the Divrei Chaim's immersions in the mikveh, he describes that almost every single time that he immersed himself, that there was such a dialogue between himself and the Almighty going on, and that there was such mesiras nefesh, there was such complete negation of self in the entire process, that the person who's in this, the narrator of this experience, says that he felt that in the process that he was going to die, like hidden in this place, that it was just that overwhelming. The Sanz Rav was not only a pillar of Torah. He was not only a pillar of Aveda, of prayer, but he also came to be known in the most unprecedented of terms as the pillar of Gemilus Chasadim. His charity was of such astronomically great proportions. I mean, here the Divrei Chaim would not go to sleep at night as long as there was one penny in the house. And if he couldn't sleep, he knew that it was because someone somewhere had hidden some money. And so he would get out of bed and he would march around the house, and on occasion he would wake up some of the kids and he would say to them, okay, who's hidden some money? And he would not go to sleep until such time as that money would be distributed to the poor. He himself became the tzedakah pushka of Galicia and Poland. Despite the constant fragile state of his health, Divrei Chaim was unable to spend any amount of time sleeping. He was so aflame with this passion for life, for divine service. There's one account which I'm not exactly certain how to reconcile it, but the source is a reliable source. The Bani Verov said that he once came in because he wanted to be there when the Divrei Chaim woke up. So he said that the Divrei Chaim woke up, and as soon as he opened up his eyes, by the way, which was a matter of a few moments, I mean, he slept this incredibly little bit of time. When he was asked about how is it possible for someone to sleep so little, so his response was, to the questioner, he said, what is the meaning of an Eloi? What's the meaning of a genius? He says, the meaning of a genius, of an Eloi, is that what it takes one person, let's say, 8 hours to learn, a genius can learn that same volume and depth of material in 15 minutes. So he says, because a genius thinks quickly. He says, when it comes to sleeping, he says, I am an ilui. He says, I sleep quickly. He says, I sleep in 15 minutes what it takes somebody else 8 hours to sleep. There are some of us who are, when it comes to sleeping, have a small IQ. But it takes somebody 8 hours to sleep, it takes some of us 12 hours to sleep. In any event, the description is that he woke up and he began to say, Moida ani, right? That's the first thing. And he said, Moida ani, then he washed his hands and he said, Moida ani lefanecha melech. Right? I am grateful to you, king. And he would repeat it, Moida ani lefanecha melech, Moida ani lefanecha melech. And he would exclaim in exasperation, I don't feel it. And he ordered his gabbai to bring him a gemara. And sitting in bed, he would learn for an hour, sometimes 2 hours. In this case, he said he learned for well over an hour. And after he learned for an hour, he closed the gemara. He says, aha, aha. He says, now I feel melech. And he completed the rest of Maidani Shechzat Binishmosi. He said, now I feel melech. So he was able to conclude Maidani. But it does, it's the anecdote does describe the richness of this of the passion of this man's divine service and the extent to which it played out in every aspect of his life. So the Divrei Chaim became, as I said, the tzedakah pushka of Poland and Galicia, and his reputation was that all three pillars of Torah and Avodah and Gemilus Chasadim had come together, had coalesced in his person, each such that where, generally speaking, people would go to a tzaddik and he would excel in one or another of these areas, he stood somehow as a unique entity, as someone who combined each one, and then each one was without peer. I would like to share with you some anecdotes about these three pillars, which we will do, God willing, the next time we meet, and maybe we can get into some of his tales. The Divrei Chaim's life was such that it really captured the finest and richest dimensions of all of Hasidus in one person and in one lifetime. So that that everything that Hasidus sought to instill became personified in his person, and the entire Hasidic world flocked to the Divrei Chaim to witness this living legend, this living miracle. His disciples, he was such that in his own time he was venerated as few other Hasidic leaders were, and indeed such was his impact that even unto this time those who were the Hasidic leaders of our generation, who were still part of the European theater before the war, all were in one way or another profoundly affected by the rabistva of the leadership of the Divrei Chaim, and there was a very special kind of deference. There was a kind of an interesting legend as it were, an interesting mystique which surrounded the Divrei Chaim. Despite the fact that clearly here was a man who had all of this this reverence for Hasidus and for his Hasidic Rabbeim, there was another part of him that remained somehow fixed in what appeared to be a certain sympathy for the misnagdic world, so that he rather than being someone who was seen as someone monolithic, he seemed to be a bridge, and at times someone who managed to carry within him this the conflict of the chassidim and misnagdim in one person. One of the things that chassidim would whisper. There was a famous response from the Noida Behuda, who was the rabbi of Prague, one of the renowned authors of response. The Noida Behuda was a virulent misnagid, and in one of his tshuvos, he was asked something about what Hasidim do, and he responded forcefully. And in the course of this responsum, he said, he paraphrased the pasuk, Tzadikim Yelchuba, how does the pasuk go? Tzadikim Yelchuba, Upashim, and the righteous walk in the way of the Torah, Upashim, and the transgressors, Yikashluba, will stumble. So the Noida Behuda paraphrased this and substituted in this tshuva for the word peshim, for the word transgressors, the word chassidim. So he wrote, Tzadikim Yilchuba, that the righteous will walk confidently and uprightly in the ways of the Torah. The Hasidim Yikashlubo, and the Hasidim will stumble instead of transgressors. And it was very clear that he intended to denigrate the Hasidim by interchanging the word Peshim, meaning these premeditated transgressors, with the word Hasidim. At a later date, they sought to reprint the Noida Behuda, and the printer was someone who had great deference to the Divrei Chaim. So when he reprinted the tshuvas, he counseled with the Rebbe, with the Divrei Chaim, and the sons of old, about the fact that he couldn't bear it to reprint this tshuva with this thing, and he was going to substitute the original pasuk. In other words, he was just going to quote the pasuk, Tzadikim walking in, and Peshim. He wasn't going to use the word chassidim. He was going to substitute the word Peshim. He was going to restore the word Peshim to where it is, excise the word chassidim. So he came to Divrei Chaim. Divrei Chaim said to him, you will not alter this tshuva a hair. He said, the Noida Behuda wrote the tshuva, and he was a person who was one of our venerated Torah giants, and we're not going to fool with it. And then he added, he said, take a look. He said, the great Noida Behuda took Peshim, and he made of them chassidim. He says, and you want to go and take chassidim and make of them peshim. Nonetheless, this legend that people repeated said as follows. He said that when the great Vilner Gaon passed on, his soul came before the heavenly tribunal. And it was his soul was so pure. It was a soul of such lustrous qualities that the heavenly tribunal was prepared to usher the soul into the highest precincts of the Olam Haba. At which point, a voice of protest was heard. A voice of protest was an angel who came to say that there was a very serious blemish upon the life of the Vilna Gaon, and that was his virulent opposition to the Baal Shem HaKodesh and to the great Hasidic leaders of his time, and that it could not simply be dismissed. So the Heavenly Tribunal was very hard put to resolve this question. There was no way in which a soul that had the greatness of the Vilna Gaon could be subjected to any punishment. At the same time, this could not be ignored. The resolution was that the soul of the Vilna Gaon had to be reincarnated in a chassid. And the Hasidic legend goes, not only was it incarnated in a chassid, but it was megulgal in a Rebbe of Hasidim. And not only was it incarnated in a Rebbe of Hasidim, but in a Rebbe of Rebbes, in the Divrei Chaim. He said, and interestingly enough, despite the fact that here was the Rebbe of his time, the Rebbe of Rebbes of Hasidim, somehow he still remained a misnagid. So we'll continue next time.
Hasidic Masters, Volume 4, is sponsored by Rabbi Yosef Feinberg and family, in honor of Rabbi Mordechai Twersky, on the Stipe Rebbe, Denver, Colorado.
Ready. Okay, now we're moving on now to the sons of Rav, whose name is known to us as Rabbi Chaim Halberstam. He was a descended from a long line of scholars, amongst whom was the rabbi of Halberstadt, which was a city someplace in Europe. And he changed it from Halberstadt to Halberstam. So the rabbinic family Halberstam, which is today well known in the Hasidic world, is one which traces its ancestry to, in the main, to Reb Chaim, although there is another Halberstam, who was Reb Chaim's brother, sons of Reb, brother Reb Avigdor, who was also a person of great spiritual stature. And I believe the writer, Halberstam, David Halberstam, was a political writer, I believe. He's some note. Is a descendant of Reb Avigdor. The son's Rav was born in 1793 in the city of Tarnograd. His father, Rabbi Yaleib, was the rabbi of Tarnograd. And was himself of a very illustrious line of rabbinic leaders, as was his mother. That is, as was Reb Chaim's mother, or this Rabbi Leib's wife. His mother had suffered a number of miscarriages, and when she was pregnant with Reb Chaim, she was very interested in trying to get some special brachos, blessings from the tzaddikim of her generation, so that she might successfully carry out this pregnancy. And in the early months of her pregnancy, she went to receive the blessing of the famous Reb Moshe Leib, the Rebbe of Sassov. When she walked into the room, Reb Moshe Leib, who was one of the tzaddiki al-dor, stood up. And he rose to his feet, and she was taken aback. He said, "I rise in deference to the Sefer Torah that you are carrying in your womb." So even at that, even before his birth, there was an aura
special distinction that revolved around this child who was destined to become the sons of Av. There's another story associated with his birth, that his father was a chassid of a Talmud, a disciple of the Moshe of Shavosk. And this Chabad Yaleib was not only a man of letters, that is, he was not only a scholar and a rav, but he was also a successful merchant. And when upon visiting his teacher, he saw that his teacher was downcast. He inquired about the anxiety of the worry, which he noticed and etched into the Rebbe's face. And his Rebbe told him that he had some daughters to marry off, and he was penniless. And when he inquired about the sum of money, it was a very, very substantial amount of money, a considerable fortune. And the Sabbatai took out the entire amount and put it on the table. At which point, his Rebbe, who was overwhelmed, said to him, in response to the magnitude of the mitzvah that you've just performed, I confer upon you my blessing that you should become the progenitor of the father of the son who will illuminate the world with his Torah. So there's a story even about the conception of Chaim. He was born a sickly child. He had a deformed leg and was constantly on the brink of, was in a very fragile state of health. And his mother, because this was a child who carried with her all this great promise and all this blessing, was extremely concerned about his health. It's related that in her concern that she took this youngster as an infant to the Chazak Kodesh of Lublin, to the Holy Seer of Lublin, and he instructed her about how to care for him, told her how he should be dressed and how he should be cared for, and gave her his blessing and his assurance that he would live a long life, and that there was a greatness of person that he saw in him, which promised that he would one day be a leader of Israel. And so, reassured with this bracha, she of course followed the Chazal's instructions and nursed Reb Chaim into his early youth, where his prodigious mind began to earn him a great deal of note in Tanigrad. He became known as the Ilui of Tanigrad. He became known as the prodigy, the genius of Tanigrad, even as a youngster. Despite his mother's care and despite the blessing, he remained somehow very vulnerable, very subject to all kinds of different illnesses that would plague him and continue to throughout his life. Later on, he recounted that as a young man, he suffered enormous pain from his teeth. He said that the diligence of study which was the only way that he could escape his pain. That his toothaches were responsible for much of the intensity of his focus and the immensity of material that he covered. So in his later years, he spoke about the fact that as a young man, that he owed a great deal to his toothaches, because the only way in which he could handle that pain was to study. At the tender age of 10 years old, he suddenly developed this yearning to visit the Chayza inwardly, and began to work on his father, that his father should escort him to the Bli. The father tried to dissuade him. They were not of a Hasidic lineage, and while there was a certain respect for the Gedolei Hasidus, nonetheless, there was no commitment and there was no profound difference there. So the father was not particularly anxious or eager to make this trip and try to tell the youngster, who had already developed this reputation as being a terrific masmid of his conscientiousness and the diligence of his studies, which were in those days were a chiddush. They were something that people did know of. But the youngster would not be dissuaded, and at the age of 10, the father escorted him to the Bli. And when he came in to the Rebbe with the youngster, the Chazal Kodesh called the youngster over, took this young Chaim on his lap, and exclaimed, "This is my Chaim. This is my Chaim." He prevailed on the father and the child to remain for a number of weeks, although this was to have been a very brief visit. And over that period of time, my lab and the youngster would daily visit with the Chayza. On one occasion, while they were visiting, a number of other Hasidim in the room, and people had come to present kvitach to the Rebbe and request his advice, his tefillos, his brachos. Abruptly, the Rebbe ordered everybody out of the room. He told his gabbai that everybody had to leave the room. Without any explanation, everybody had to leave the room. This little 10-year-old had the presence of mind that as everybody was being shuffled out of the room, there was a tumult. He hid. He wanted to see what the Rebbe was going to do when nobody was looking. So, after everybody left, the Rebbe sat down and learned Mishnayos for a brief period of time. And then he called for the Gaba and said that everybody could once again, he was prepared to receive his Hasidim. And this continued on for a number of hours until he finished seeing all of his Hasidim. Of course, meanwhile, in the tumult of coming and going, this little Chaim had once again kind of mingled with the crowd. But after everyone was about to leave, the Rebbe sent for the youngster. And he said to him, "So, Chaim, what did you see?" So he said, "Now, Rebbe, what did I see?" So he said, "Let me explain something to you." He said, "When the Almighty created the world, he said, initially he created a remarkable and splendid light. But he saw that light was of such force and power that it could be misused by the wicked. So he took that light and he concealed it. And why do you think he concealed it, Chaim?" He said he concealed it in the letters of the Torah. So he said, "When I sit with my chassidim," he says, "I am called upon to advise them. And in order for me to advise them, I must be able to see. I must be able to discern what's going on inside of them. I must be able to see what's going on around them. I must look forward into time. I must understand everything I can understand so that I can advise them to their ultimate benefit. So he said, where would I get such faculties? Where would I get such power? He said, but if you know how to learn the Torah, then you can immerse yourself. You can get beyond the letters of the Torah, and you can immerse yourself in that splendid light which is concealed in the Torah. And he says, unless you get into that light, you can see everything you need to see. So he said, here I was advising my Hasidim, and suddenly he says, I saw that I couldn't see. I was unable to function. And I realized, so to speak, that I had used up the light. I needed to recharge. So I asked everybody to go out. He said, I sat down and learned. I recharged my batteries. He says it. And then I was able to, once again, to receive chassidim. And I was able, once again, to advise them accordingly. And this was a lesson which the Bible claimed, which the sons of never forgot. It was a lesson that he learned very early in life. So he had an experience, even as a child, in the company of the Chayz HaKadosh, which certainly imprinted itself upon his neshama in a very indelible way. Before he left, the Chayz HaKadosh once again reaffirmed a statement which had now been prophesied not only by the Moshe Leib of Sasov and by himself earlier, that this young Chaim was destined to become one of the giants of the coming generation. As a youngster of either 16 or 17, when he was learning in, I should tell you another interesting fact. He was a student of some of the Gaonim of his generation, although he considered amongst his primary rabbein in Migla, that is, in the study of Talmud in the Halacha, the author of the Yama Talmud. Let's see, his last name is Ornstein, but we have his name here someplace. Rav Moshe Yehoshua Heschel Ornstein. He was a brother of the Yeshuas Yankiv, who at that time was one of the towering Gaonim of the Jewish world. And he would refer to this rabbi, to Moshe Yehoshua Heschel Ornstein, as Meiri the Rabbi, at the age of 13. At his bar mitzvah, this great Goyim, the author of the Yama Talmud, one of the famous Svarim, ordained this youngster with Smichas Heira. He placed his hands upon him and acknowledged him worthy of being someone who could decide the complicated questions of halacha. At the age of 16 or so, on one occasion, Rabbi Yeshua Heschel Teumim Frankel, who was the son of someone who was known throughout the scholarly world as the Rabbi of Leipzig, or the Baruch Tam, Rabbi Baruch Teumim Frankel, the Rabbi of Leipzig, was one of the halachic geniuses of the era. Someone who was revered by all of the Gaonim, all of the Torah giants, the Torah luminaries of the time. This Reb Baruch to Aaron Frankel, the Leibnik of Ob, the Leibnik of Ob had a son, Reb Yeshua Heschel. This Reb Yeshua Heschel, who was in his own right, a gifted Talmudic scholar, was traveling on business. And he happened to be in the city of Tarnograd. Of course, after you complete this business, where does a Jew go? To the Beis HaMedrash. So he went to the Beis HaMedrash to study, to learn. And there he saw a youngster, 15, 16 years old or so, who was so focused on his learning that absolutely nothing that took place distracted him. So he was very drawn to this youngster. So he went over to the youngster and began to talk to him. And he saw that this young man was brilliant. Just, and when he spoke to him, he saw his Yerushalayim, he saw his Midas Tavis. He just was overwhelmed with this. And he began to question this youngster who he was, discovered that he was a Baravon, that he was the son of the rabbi of the community, and that he was a descendant of the famous Maharshal, the Chacham Shlomo, that he was a descendant of the Chacham Tzvi, that this was someone who came from a family of great Torah leaders for generations, and that he himself was this amazing, brilliant young man. So he immediately sat down and wrote a letter to his father, telling his father that he had found a worthy mate for his sister, Baruch Tam's, Leibnikov's daughter, Baruch Fegera. He had found a worthy mate, that this young man was everything. He was a Bar Midas Tavis, he was a mensch, and he was brilliant, and he was a walking library, and he just went on and on. He neglected record one fact in the letter, and that is that this young man had a crippled foot, and that he limped noticeably when he walked. There was clearly something wrong. Completely ignored that fact. The letter arrived in Leipnik, addressed to his father, precisely at the moment when the Tanigrad Rav, Reb Chaim's father, who was in Leipzig on business, was visiting the Baruch Tam. So there were these two people, and this letter arrives, and they're trying to figure out for whom was it. On the one hand, it was from Leipzig. It was from Tanigrad, so one would have thought that it was intended for the rabbi of Tanigrad. On the other hand, the address said to Rabbi Baruch, to Omim Frankel, the rabbi of Leipnik. So the Baruch Tam opened the letter, and there was this letter from his son saying that he just met this remarkably unique young man who was, in his estimation, the absolutely perfect mate for his sister, Rachel Fegela, who was the son of the rabbi of Tanigrad. So the Leibnikov was astounded, because this was, even for people who are somewhat skeptical about Bashert, this was a choreography that could not be ignored. So he shared the letter with Tanigrad, and he said to him, "Would you be amenable to this?" The Tanigrad was now less impressed by the way in which these events had coalesced, and said that he saw it as ordained from heaven, that it should be orchestrated in the way in which it took place, and that he was agreeable. At which point, the Baruch Tam said to him, "There is one qualification here. The qualification is that the Goyim of Brod, this was the Bafram Zalman Margolius, the Goyim of Brod had already arranged with him a shidduch with his son. Now, the Reform Zalman Gaonis, in addition to being one of the Gaonim of his man, one of the Talmudic, the great Talmudic authorities of his time, also happened to be one of the wealthiest Jews in Europe. So this was really a great shidduch. This was something that was totally different. There were a few families that had that magnitude of both scholarship and an influence in the same room. Usually they worked against one another. So, while the Leipzig Rebbe was prepared to do the shidduch, the Reform Zalman Margolis said he wanted some time to think about it, and said, please give me your word that you will wait until the 15th day of Shvat, I believe it was, to be Shvat, that you will do nothing until such time. I will get back to you before that time. If I don't get back to you to confirm the shidduch, you are free to do whatever you want. So he said to the Rabbi of Talmud, he said to him, today is the 15th day of Shvat. I'm obliged to wait until night. If I don't get word by tonight, we'll do the shidduch. The Talmud Rabbi of Talmud went back to the hotel, the Kretschmer, where he was staying, and a guest arrived. Who was the emissary from the Bethlehem Zalman Margolis? And he had a shtar hashah. He had a power of attorney to conclude the shidduch. The man arrived, he was tired. And he was hungry. So he sat down to eat. The day was still long. He asked for a room so that he could rest a little bit. And after eating a full meal, he went to lie down for a few minutes. And he slept into the night. After Milo, the Leibnik Rav sent for the Tanya Gadol Rav, and he said to him, I fulfilled my end of the bargain. I waited up until nightfall. It's no longer Chamisha Asar, but I'm free to do what I want. They sat down to work tonight. So they concluded the shidduch. Fellow, the emissary, when he did wake up, he took a look at the clock. It was around midnight. He concluded that it was impertinent on his part that he should bother the dog at that hour of the night. And so he put his power of attorney papers into his pocket and concluded that he would finish this matter up the following morning. After the davening, he presented himself to the Leibnik Rav. He said, I'm here from Rabbi Ephraim Zalman Margolis, and I have the Shtar HaShoah, at which point he was informed that he had waited, and that last night when he didn't arrive, that he had written Tanayim with the Tanya Gadol Rav. Needless to say, this fellow was a night disconcerted about the business, and he pleaded with the Leibnik Rav to negate the Tanayim that he had written. So the Leibnik Rav said, you know what, the Tanya Gadol Rav is here. You're welcome to propose to him. If he's willing, then I'll accept his decision. The Tanya Gadol Rav, however, was convinced that this was a heavenly ordained thing. All the ways in which it transpired, refused to renege or to negate the contract of the betrothal contract at the time which had just been written, and the emissary was forced to return to the Bethlehem Zion with his embarrassment in hand, and the shidduch with the Leibnik Rav was a done deal. However, to the extent that not everything is a done deal until it's a done deal, the disciples of the Leibniz Kulov were very disturbed that their teacher had not personally interviewed his son-in-law to be. And so they protested that while they had great trust in the judgment of Rabbi Shur Heschel, the Leibniz Kulov's son, who was the maven over here, that nonetheless the rabbi himself should have conducted this interview. So the Leibniz Kulov, in deference to their protests, dispatched two of his most distinguished Talmidim, his disciples, to travel to Taligrad to test the young man. They returned, duly impressed with the stature, the character, and the personality of this young man. However, they also carried with them this one little bit of information, which Rabbi Shua Heschel had neglected to include in his letter, which was that the chosn was a cripple. Now, they didn't deliver this news to the Rebbe himself because they knew that this would cause him great pain. However, it did get out until the Robinson found out about it, and ultimately the Rachel Fogler found out about it, and she came running to her father hysterically about the fact that she had been betrothed to a cripple. But Tom summoned his son, and he admonished him accordingly. And the young man said to him, "Father, send for the chosn." He said, "You will see that if you talk to him, that there is no blemish." So they sent for the young man to come to Leibniz. And he came to Leibniz. And the Baruch Tam was profoundly impressed with him. But Rachel Fogler was not a great maven on his particular genius. And she saw someone who was a cripple. So she could not be comforted, and the Baruch Tam turned to the young man and said, I don't know what to do here. At which point, Reb Chaim said, "Let me talk to her privately." Now, privately, obviously, in those times for a young man and young woman was not privately as we know it today, but nonetheless they were able to speak to one another where what was said was not audible or discernible to others. It is, however, known that upon the conclusion of what it was that they spoke about in these moments of privacy, that she came out fully agreeable to the shidduch. The story is told that when she was alone with the chosn, that he said to her, "You are taken aback by my physical, because I'm disfigured." So he said, "Come with me and look into the mirror." And when she looked into the mirror, she saw that she had a deformed leg. So he said to her, "When my soul descended to this world, I saw that you who were destined to be my bride was to be the bearer of this deformity. So I asked that I bear the deformity in your stead." Which point are objections to this match were removed. They were married. of 17 to the age of 18 for a year. The son-in-law, Reb Chaim, spent virtually the entirety of every day learning with his father. Years and years later, when the Leibnikov was no longer alive, and the Divrei Chaim was already one of the recognized giants of his generation, he printed one of the manuscripts of his father's learned scholarly commentaries. In the introduction, he wrote as follows. He said, when I was 17 years old, he said, I had the good fortune of learning under the tutelage of my illustrious father-in-law. He said, in the year that I spent with him, we learned through almost the entirety of Shas with all of the Rishonim. Now, I can't begin to tell you what that means, but I can tell you that it takes a world-class genius to be able to do that. And he says, Rav Shas im Rishonim. He said that since he was young, he was also impetuous enough that after a year, he asked to be able to leave and set up his own home. His father-in-law was reluctant to give his blessing to that, but Reb Chaim prevailed, and he always lamented the fact that he did not listen to his father-in-law, because he said that period of time that he studied under his father-in-law was a period of time which he could never again recreate. He continued to be in close contact, and his father-in-law continued to be a great resource who really shaped the halachic temperament that the Divrei Chaim was to become known for. After this, about age 18, he became the rabbi of the city of Rybnik. And here again, there was kind of an interesting occurrence. The majority of this city of Rybnik were Rabshitza Hasidim. We have to understand that up until this point, that while the Divrei Chaim had some very positive and formative experiences with the Hasidic world, especially his early experiences with the Chayza, that nonetheless, his family were essentially a family who were more of the Misnagdic tradition, and the Baruch Tam himself was of the Misnagdic whatever posture, so that the Divrei Chaim, the sons of Obed, did not really have any particular penchant to pursue this Hasidic business. When he was a candidate for the rabbinate of Rybnik at age 18, the Hasidim of the Rabshitza Rov went to their Rebbe to discuss which of the candidates they should choose, and they told him about this young man who was not a Hasidic person, but who came with these brilliant credentials. At which point, the Rabshitza Rov opened up the Chumash and pointed to the Pasuk which says, behold, I set before you this day life. And in the Pasuk is, Re'ein lefnechem hayam es hachayim, I place before you hachayim. So he pointed to this Pasuk, and he said nothing more. the Chassidim understood that that meant that they should take this fellow whose name is Chaim as their Rav, and he became the rabbi of Budnik. However, being the rabbi in a community that had this very passionate following of the rabbi of Rav Shitz, the rabbi of Rav was interested after hearing all the things that they were saying and seeing and meeting this great Hasidic leader. So he went to Rav Shitz. And in Rav Shitz, the Rav Shitz had captured his soul. So he was, from that point forward, he became far and away the most outstanding of the disciples of the Rav Shitz of old.